All Ball. I'm your boy, Doug Gottlieb, and I am I'm really, really excited about your thoughts on this week's guest. To me, I love stories of guys that they kind of work through things, right? That's what I and when I remember when Kyle McElarney got suspended at Notre Dame and had to leave Notre Dame and then went back to Notre Dame and made it his junior and senior year. And I followed him playing overseas for years. I followed him when he came back to become a high school coach, and now he's trying to be an agent. Like, I love guys like, hey, that's a chapter, but there's other chapters to the book. So instead of talking about college basketball schedules, I'm fascinated by them. I love this idea of playing the same team on back-to-back nights. I think it's cool. It reminds me of playing minor league basketball, right? You play a team and then you play a team again, and you know, there will be no doubters. If you beat a team two games in a row, there's like no doubt who the better team is. And there's a mental advantage you hold over that team if you ever see them again. But the idea that you could play a team four times in a season in a stretch of just two trips each way, like home and home, that feels crazy to me. Crazy, crazy to me. But instead of getting into college schedules or the preseason All-American or award stuff, we can do that upcoming next week. I wanted to bring you this interview. Kyle McElarney is now? He's 33 years old. He's from Staten Island, New York, and just a stud ball player, and I think a great guy to have around the game for a long time. This is me catching up with Kyle. All right, let's welcome him in because he's now moved from player to coach at Moore Catholic High School, I believe. He's the pride of Staten Island, of course, played at Moore Catholic. We'll get to his entire basketball journey as much as we can here in the All Ball Podcast. He's Kyle McElarney. Kyle, how are you?
Great, Doug. Thanks for having me on, man. And I just have to correct you. I vacated that position. I'm now working for Priority Sports here in Chicago, and I'm sort of like a hybrid role here, working to become an agent, but also training everybody in the company. So I left that. I left my my hometown and my home school. I'm on the board now. I'm still involved, but it was a great 2 years when I was there. It was a good transition for me.
That's pretty cool. Okay, why the mask?
I'm in the East Bank Club here in Chicago, and I had the mask off, and some guy came around and knocked on the door and said I have to wear the mask at all times while I'm in the building. And in an effort not to get kicked out of here. I figured I'd keep it on.
That's fair. So, I just didn't know what level of like, cause I feel like we're like, at least my family, we're like in the middle. Like we didn't do Halloween trick or treating because that's like giving everybody the middle finger. We know more than doctors and scientists. On the other hand, sometimes I watch on TV and there are people that are standing all alone with a camera that's way off in the distance. And I'm like, okay, it's overdoing it a little bit. I feel like you got to make kind of sound, sensible decisions to be somewhere in the middle. Is that fair?
Totally. We did the trick or treating thing at a distance where I was. People set up candy on the front lawns and things like that. And I was a little bit uncomfortable with the amount of people that were out. But you know, I try and do my best to play my part. So.
Okay, there's a bunch of things I want to get to. They're more important.
Let's get the best
than our children's trick-or-treating. Let's start with
please.
You, okay? Yeah. You grew up on Staten Island, right? And it's like New York, but it's different than the rest of the boroughs, I feel like. There's a uniqueness to Staten Island. What was it like growing up as a hooper in Staten Island?
I'm glad you put it that way because it is different. It is New York City. We're a borough of New York City, but growing up in Staten Island, you're insulated a little bit. Staten Island is where the cops and the firemen live and the teachers and the nurses. It's a very blue collar area. But it's an island, literally speaking, it's an island. And the competition on Staten Island for basketball is not that good. It's not that good. So that's why I was able to score so many points in high school. My exposure came from AAU.
Sure.
But what had happened was I started to develop, I started to become well-known, at least on Staten Island, and, you know, newspaper articles and people were deeming me the best player ever on Staten Island. And it really propped me up. But the general consensus for people who know is you're not good. You're not anything. You ain't shit until you test yourself within the city. and off Staten Island, because the basketball, just quite frankly, it's just not good. It's just not
Well,
very good at
it's
all.
interesting because about, I don't know, about 2 years ago, I put out a tweet, maybe it was a year ago, that the like little known secret is that there's just not as many players, or not players in New York like there used to be, even when you were coming out, just because so many people have moved. And obviously, this is before quarantine, where now a lot, any families, of course, can move out, but it feels like, one, most kids don't go to, they don't want to go to college in the city, let alone even high school in the city. And then now you're getting more and more families move out to the burbs, or just move away because it's so crazy. It has been previously so crazy expensive to live in Manhattan. What was the hoop like? Like, who are the other guys in Manhattan and the other boroughs in the surrounding areas your graduating year? What was that crew like?
So the year before me was Basti, Sebastian Telfair. He was the year before me. My year, Zavarian won the city championship, and that was LaVance Fields, point guard from Pitt. I was actually slated to go to Zavarian, which is right over the bridge in Brooklyn, to play with LaVance. Wound up not going because my high school was like 2 minutes from my house. So my parents were like, "Yeah, you're not going there. Like, we'll take up the block. It's fine." So LaVance Fields, he was. My opinion, he was the best player in the city. I thought he was better than me at the time. Great ball handler, controlled the game, and demonstrated on a level that I never had the chance to do. So he was big. Sebastian was before me. My class wasn't that strong. Greg Paulus, a lot of people talked about him because he was upstate, but it was really us three in the entire New York State. I mean, my class really wasn't that strong in New York City at the time.
You know, it's interesting. So Bassey was at the McDonald's game that year. I called it. It was in Oklahoma City, and that year I believe there was like eight dudes. J.R. Smith was one of them. Obviously, Dwight Howard was the number one or number two pick. I can't remember. It was him or Emeka Okafor, right? And I remember going to the restaurant that became, I forget who it was called before. It was became KD's restaurant. But it was before KD went to was there. And after the workouts one night, and you know, all the scouts you're around, and I was like, one of you guys is gonna do it. Like, what do you mean? I was like, one of you guys is gonna take him, and it's gonna be a mistake. And it was Sebastian Telfair. And I actually, there's a lot of Bassey that I like in that he was a creative passer, he's quick. I mean, he's kind of your classic atypical New York City point guard, right? Can get to the rim or can make a play off penetration, but he just didn't have. He didn't have the size of Steph, right? He was his cousin, and he did, so he wasn't as powerful, as able to, you know, adjust to the pro game defensively where they expose you. Couldn't really shoot, and just wasn't real, like everything with him had to be some sort of fancy pass or something a little bit over the top. It was just too much city game. And he just needed, like, he was supposed to go to Louisville. Like, that would have been perfect for him, right? To get, just refine him a little bit before he got there, because they throw you out, they put you out in the deep end. And you're 18 years old and they're coming at you. And then you have all the other things going on in your personal life. But you and LaVance had amazing, amazing college career. So why Notre Dame? Why did you pick Notre Dame?
Because I had the opportunity to play as a freshman, bottom line.
That's why I went there.
A lot of people like to throw the narrative out there from, McElarney is my last name, Irish Catholic kid, right? Yeah. Of course, the Notre Dame thing appealed to my parents. The academics, of course. But if I'm giving you my real answer, it's because Coach Bray told me that I had an opportunity to start as a freshman. And that to me was the most important. And that's actually the advice I give to a lot of kids these days, is go where you're going to play, because that's where you're going to be happier.
You're gonna be happy, right? Like, no one, I like, I God bless people that can sit there and cheer. Like, I remember, you know, I that's why I went to Notre Dame, was McLeod said I'd be the starting point guard right away. And you know, the programs that I turned down, it was because it wasn't that case, right? I mean, that was just very, very simple. And what's interesting is my first year out, we won a championship in Russia, and I like split time, and I was miserable, right? Like, we literally won every game but one game the entire time I was in Russia, which is like unheard of. We won our EuroLeague, we won the Russian League. We lost one game, one.
Right.
And I was miserable, because I wasn't, I'm so, you know, you're like wired, used to playing 30, 35 minutes. You're like, man, I don't want to sit here. Like, I don't care what
You don't
bonus
you
I
want to
get.
you don't feel a part of it. So for me, and I had Chris Quinn was a senior when I was a freshman. Colin Falls was a junior when I was a freshman, but Coach Bray was like, man, you know, I want to play 3-4 guards, guys who could shoot it, pass it, handle it, freedom, you know, free motion style offense, no rules really. And I was like, let's go, I'm ready. So for me, that was the main thing. Was the other stuff was honestly, it was icing on top of the cake. I wanted to play. I wanted to play right away, and I didn't want to wait. And that was the only reason why I went there.
Okay, so we did no pre-interview meeting or whatever, but I did want to ask you about the suspension. You cool with that?
Yeah, of course.
Okay,
of course.
So yeah. For people who don't remember, like, you're in the conversation of best guard in the Big East. I'm going to say you were a junior at the time.
I was a sophomore. I was
a sophomore. Okay.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden it pops up that you test positive for weed. Take me through.
I got arrested.
Oh, you got arrested
for having weed? Yeah. So I'll tell you the story. So it was my sophomore year. Chris Quinn graduates. Here's the ball, right? Your program. Ironically, it was actually after my best game to date. I think I had 7 threes. I forget who we played. It was December 26th. It was day after Christmas. And I am at a buddy's house, and I'm driving home by myself, and I was smoking a little weed, and I got pulled over for not signaling for a lane change, and they arrested me and they took me to jail, and I spent the night in jail. And basically we were on break then, right? So there was no classes. So
you stayed at the hotel?
We were staying. Yeah. We stayed at the Residence Inn down there in South Bend. Yeah. So horrible time for me, but there was no classes. So as you know, the way Notre Dame works is they have the student affairs committee or whatever. It's sort of like they weren't in either.
Honor committee. I think it was like an honor committee, right?
Yeah. And so they basically told me, you got to wait until we get back, until class gets back in session, until everybody's back on campus. Coach Bray, in the meantime, suspended me indefinitely from the basketball team for games, but I was allowed to practice and travel with the team. So for the whole Christmas break, I practiced with the team and I traveled with the team. We went to Villanova and went to Georgetown during that stretch. And at this point, you're already talking about it on ESPN. So at this point, the word's out there. The whole arena's chanting at me, you know, that kind of deal.
What was the funniest chant? By the way, it was Ryder. I just want to correct you. It was Ryder on the December 28th. Was when you had 7 threes. Ryder College, not 26.
Yeah, yeah. So,
but you definitely had 7 threes.
But they were chanting, pothead. Do you want to smoke a joint after the game? And it wouldn't stop, you know?
I love the idea, though, that like college students, many of whom smoked a joint either before or after the game, are giving you shit about it. Like the irony to it is amazing. Yeah. Okay, I got a bunch of questions though. Okay, I got a bunch of questions.
Yeah.
I've never understood smoking in the car, right? That's the one that I don't get. Fully candid. Yeah, I smoked weed a little bit in college. Never during the season. We were petrified of getting caught, right? And it was a little bit before you, and obviously times have kind of changed in how people view it. But we were just like, yeah, I'm not in season. So it was very, very rarely, and it was out of season. But I never understood the cruise along, because it's like, if you do it in your apartment or somebody else's apartment, the only chance you can get caught is if you get caught when they test you. And even then, as long as it's not a conference or an NCAA test, it's like a slap on the wrist, right? So why in the car?
Because I smoked weed by myself. I was not a social, I didn't do it in groups. It gave me anxiety. I actually developed panic attacks. I did it honestly, and this we can go back. When I watch Chris Herron's story, when I first watched it, I sort of resonated with it a little bit. The pressure of that. You know, when you're put on a pedestal at such a young age and you're depicted as this perfect kid, good grades, great athlete, he's going to Notre Dame, making us all proud, this and that. When I got to Notre Dame, I really I struggled a little bit socially because I really didn't have an outlet. I couldn't escape that pressure. And I, quite frankly, I turned to weed because it was the only thing that gave me sort of a little bit of an escape from that pressure. It's sort of like a little bit of release. So why in the car? Because I did it by myself. Because I wasn't a guy who was out there doing it, throwing in everybody else's faces. I wasn't like that. I was a loner when I did it. And that's the reason why is because it was the only way for me to kind of like release all this tension and pressure on my shoulders.
It's really fascinating because, you know, obviously the shit I did is way stupider, right? And easier to track. And I don't think it was as much of a release, but I do completely understand the idea of like, yeah, you're like, you create them for yourself, these expectations. Right.
Yeah.
And I remember like the thing about Notre Dame, and I actually now I respect it even more, is like, you legitimately have to go to school and legitimately have to study. And I just remember being overwhelmed. Like, you know, high school shit's easy. I like, you know, if you pay attention and you study a little bit, you're going to get an A or a B. And that was good enough. Right. And then, you know, like my SAT was good enough. Right. Everything was just good enough and you could get by. Like, there, everybody's smart and everybody's focused, you know, or if not, they kind of weed it out. And then you have basketball, and basketball's way, I felt like it was just, it was way harder than I thought it would be. You know, like I've done this my whole life. I was born for this, you know?
So I averaged 35 points a game for 2 years in high school.
Right.
I scored 2,566 points in high school. I came in on my, I think, was it my visit or the first day at Notre Dame? We were just playing twos in the pit, which was the practice facility.
Yep.
Chris Quinn busted my ass so bad.
Yep.
That I walked out of that gym almost in tears, you know, almost in tears.
I think everybody's been there. I think we create this thing. This is why I'm against the, even the one and done. I think everybody should go like at least 2 years of college, right? Because that first year, you're going to get your ass kicked in the first like 3 months by all the veteran dudes, right? They're bigger, they're faster, they're stronger. They know kind of the game. They know how everything kind of works. And they're going to, and eventually like your talent comes out once you kind of figure stuff out, but your body's going to change too, because no matter what trainer you worked with in high school, like I work with Marv Runovich, he's a great renowned trainer. You get to college, you start taking some creatine, they start putting some meat on you, like everything, your whole body changes, and you have to worry about your game changing while everything else kind of changes. I think like that's like the best thing for everybody. Levels you off. You're like, wait, I'm not one of the best basketball players on earth. I might not be even be the best point guard in this gym. And I thought the coaches told me I was.
Right.
Why am I not? Like, I think that's I think that's kind of the beauty of the whole thing.
It is. And I think everybody, you're right, has to go through that in order to grow and get better.
Yeah.
And for me, that first day, I mean, Chris Quinn was, you know, underrated point guard in Big East history. He really, really good player. But I'm not downplaying his talent, but he kicked my ass, man. And from that point on, it made me work differently. It made me see the game a little bit differently. But at the same time, I had this added pressure from back home that I couldn't fuck up.
So you get in trouble, spend the night in jail, and now you're in the cell phone era, right? Because I was before cell phones, right? So I had to wait. Yep. You know, when all my stuff went down, it wasn't until it came out in the newspaper, and then all of a sudden, you know, people looked at you different. What was it like in those next couple of days? In terms of who had your back that to this day you will not forget?
Well, my teammates, every single one of them. So I'll just run you through. The first phone call I made was to my father, and he ripped me a new asshole, so to speak. And then a day later, he was like, all right, we got to get through this. Let's get through it. So my parents were unbelievable to me during the whole process. Then I went to see Coach Bray at about 7 a.m. the next morning to let him know about everything that happened. And then we had a team meeting, and I told the team, and they had my backs from that moment on. They didn't act differently towards me. They supported me through the entire process. And basically I relied solely on them. I stayed there for the next couple of weeks because I was awaiting, you know, classes to resume and, the student affairs committee to meet and, you know, see my case or whatever. And so that whole time I was in the gym, I practiced with the team and really just laid low. But it was a dark time. It was pretty dark because I didn't know what the future was going to hold. And it's funny, during that time, actually, I had to do community service. I had [S2] Right. [S1] To do drug counseling. And I had to, I had to see this drug counselor, and it was just really awkward because I'm not an addict, and
right, right. Like, I just smoked a joint to relax, right? Like, it's you don't want to downplay the stupidity of it, but it's the stupidity because I remember I had this exact same, you know, Pat Garrity is a dear friend of mine, he's my teammate, and he was like a biochem major, and he was like, you do know that THC is less harmful than nicotine. And I was like, Pat, are you advocating for me to smoke weed? He's like, no, he's like, I'm just telling you, like, the whole thing is so screwy. It doesn't make any sense. Yeah. And, you know, so yeah, okay. So how did you make it back? What was the process like of making it back?
So, I got suspended, and it was a pretty, pretty tough thing to swallow because at this point we're like 3 or 4 weeks from the arrest. And Coach Bray, you know, he supported me through the whole thing, but I don't even think he knew what the administration was going to do. So they came down with the hammer and they actually told me that if I don't leave campus within 48 hours, they're going to arrest me. So I vividly remember standing up and, you know, I think I said, fuck this. And I walked out, I threw all my Notre Dame clothes on the floor and I got in my car and I left campus. I went to my uncle's house, who lived in Ohio, but for the next couple months, I started to get recruiting phone calls again. I was getting re-recruited. Sean Miller, when he was at Xavier, I was close to transferring. I was very, very close to transferring. Coach Bray flew back to New York. He brought a jersey with him. He sat in the house with my parents and I for like 4 hours in Staten Island, and he re-recruited me. He resold me on the entire program. He resold me on sort of my comeback story. And I just felt like, you know what, I made a commitment to this program, and I want to, my teammates who have my back, I want to spend some more time with them. I want to, you know, solidify those relationships for the rest of my life. And I went back. I went back in June of 2008.
What do you remember about your first game back? First home game?
First home game back, I remember I led the team out on the floor to the fight song, and
you played LIU, by the way.
Yeah, no tears, no chills. I was angry that year. I was angry. That was my best year. That was my best year. I was able to tap into. I think any player can probably speak to this. There's certain moments where, you know, you're able to harness your energy in some sort of a way.
Yeah,
and use it for the game, whether it's whatever
that's,
it is. And,
that's it, dude.
Yeah.
I have an 11-year-old son, and I don't know how big he'll be. I don't know how good he'll be or whatever, but this is the honest discussion that we've had. I said, and I talk about my daughters as well. Like, you know, that thing, that nervousness you have, the pressure you feel of wanting to win, of wanting to look good for your buddies, you know, wanting to help the team, you wanted to play, you know, if you want to, you carry a burden of trying to play for me or play well for your parents, whatever, like the best find a way to use that as their energy. Whereas the people that don't, they allow it to bring them down. Right. Sure. And you can, it's a choice. Now, look, some of it, it's a really hard for kids mentality. It was hard for, I think, us, even as high level athletes. But I think that's the deal right there, right? Because
yep.
You're like, look, some dudes just wake up angry and want to kill everybody every day, and they use that towards hoop. But to people who are like, feel kind of this pressure and anxiety and stress and excitement over performance, I think that's the deal. Is how do you harness that and use that as your fuel?
Yeah, and I don't know how you do it. Like, I don't know if I could verbalize it, you know, better than just you figure it out. You figure out how to sit with this feeling. And that's what I remember about the first game. And that's what carried me through that entire season, was like every game I went into just like angry, you know, and looking to prove people not wrong, because I was where I was supposed to be. But, you know, I wanted to to reintroduce myself or
well, that's a moment. That's not who you are, right? You're not you're not some dude smoking J's, you know, trolling through
playing
South
video
Bend.
Games. Yeah.
Like
you're a hooper. Yeah.
And whatever and you move on. You know, you had a very successful European career now, obviously before coming back to the States. I do wonder though, like in terms of what a backup guard looks like in the NBA to just make the league, you got to be able to shoot. You were a great shooter. You got to be tough. You're tougher than shit, right? You got to be able to run a team. You could do that. Why do you think you didn't make it to the league?
I think it was, I think I would have struggled. So I don't think it's wrong defensively. It wasn't a quickness issue. It was a size issue. I mean, I'm 5'11". Yeah. I'm 5'11". And I fully believe to this day I'm the best shooter in the world, right? Like I'll walk on the court and, you know, we'll get on the court together and we'll talk shit. And you know, you're not beating me in the game of horse. I fully believe that, right? And I fully believe that at the time. So in terms of skill, in terms of speed, I thought I was there. In terms of quickness, end to end, maybe not there, but you know, staying in front of guys, I thought I did a good, decent enough job.
Yeah.
But size,
it's hard, man.
I worked my ass. Yeah, I worked my ass off in the weight room, but I never really felt that I could like take a bump and kind of stay on my ground. As hard as I worked in the weight room, I never felt true basketball strength on the court. So I think it was a size issue for me. It was a size. I think the questions were, who can I guard? And I think they were right. I don't know. I think I would have struggled. I think I really would have struggled defensively.
Your best experience playing overseas was where?
In France. So I played in France 7 years. I played 9 years overseas, and seven of them were in France. 2 years with Limoges, and then 5 years with Orléans. And that's where I finished my career. And that was a choice more than anything.
You're just done?
Well, after my second year in Limoges, I was playing pretty well. I had an opportunity to go to Spain. But my wife at the time and I, we were having conversations. And I just didn't want to, you know, I wanted to create more of a stable lifestyle for her and I. And so we could start a family. And we liked the city of Orléans. And they just kept offering me 2-year contracts. So I just kept signing them. And I felt like this is a good city. This is a good team. I love the fans, the club. It's about an hour south of Paris. And we kind of made it a home there. And for me, that was my entire 5 years there was the best experience of my life.
Tell me if you think this is wrong. So I had Phil Hickey on, who played with me at Notre Dame, and he talked about how he couldn't do the minor league basketball thing. And I kind of expressed it the same thing. It's so hard to go somewhere where people aren't about team and they're about getting somewhere else, right? Yeah. How can I get to somewhere other than where I am now? Which is, I do feel like, and I don't think it's just prone to Notre Dame guys. I think it's a lot of guys that have a really good college experience. It's like you said, you want to come back for your teammates, right? Those are your boys. Those are your guys you ride or die with, right? Yeah. And I don't know if everybody is wired that way, but I do think there's a healthy dose of that from guys that had really good college careers. And the reason that they enjoy European basketball, maybe then slugging it out to try and make it here, is the idea that it is more of a team. It can be more of a family if you stay in the same place. The hard part is when bounce team to team. Yes. I could not get down with that. I really, really, I struggle with, like, I remember winning a Russian championship and I was like, I don't care. I like that I'm getting a bonus, but I physically don't care. I'm still pissed we lost to Florida in the Elite Eight and Oklahoma my last home game. I don't give a shit. We just beat Unix Kazan to win the Russian championship. Yeah. Don't care. Yeah. And I think that's kind of what you tapped into. You smartly, you knew yourself, and that, like, I'm better off knowing and loving the people that I'm here and having a real connection than just chasing the check, which is what most people do.
Yeah. And there were some things that fell in my favor. You know, I actually played with the same group of Americans for 2.5 to 3 years over there in Orléans. Great guys. Dave Noel from North Carolina, Marcellus Somerville from Bradley, Darnell Harris from LaSalle, Brian Green from Colorado, a couple guys who are now my I have the sort of that second wave of college teammates in them. Great guys, man. And so that would fell in my favor. But it's interesting. I kind of want to take a look at that, like Notre Dame guys, Duke guys, Stanford, you know, guys from those kind of a program.
Virginia,
are they able on a grand scale? Like, what are the numbers? Like, are they able to successfully have a European career? Because I actually would argue that they're not.
I would. Okay, so why do you think that is? I have a hypothesis. I want yours.
I don't know.
I think a lot of them, they know that, like, look, they did the basketball.
They got a job and something else.
It's like, I'm going to be – there's not the – this is all they have. Like, I remember I was in the, like I tell you all the time, I was in the IBA. So I was supposed to play for a team that played in Russia and St. Petersburg, but trained in Italy. My agent, Herbert Doy, at the time, it was just a weird year. We're going to do that for half the year. And then you transferred to a different team. And then I didn't get my Israeli passport. So that fell through. And I had to come back. I was with the Lakers. They cut me before I got to the vet camp. So I went to the CBA. And beat out like 13 dudes, and then Randy Livingston got cut the day before the season. So then they cut me because Randy Livingston's 6'5", you know, pro. Anyway, so I actually called a couple of games, did some local radio, stayed healthy, and then went to Salina for like 6 games. And we played 2 games in Des Moines, back-to-back nights. I did with no practice, and then we bussed to like Salina, Kansas, wearing like a sleeper bus. And I just remember that like I was looking around going, I can't do this. You know, I love basketball. I can't do this. And I was taken by most of the guys in the bus. Like, this is all they had. This is it. And so I think some of that breeds some of these guys that are like, they become really good pros, great pros, because that desperation kind of fuels their energy. Whereas I think some of it for the Stanfords, the Notre Dames, the Virginias, the Vanderbilts of the world, like those guys like the lifestyle, like living overseas, but like, yo, I don't need this shit. You know, like,
and unless you're playing EuroLeague, it's tough. You know, I never played EuroLeague, so I was just in like France, you know, so domestic, one game a week. You know, you kind of fall into like a 9-to-5 routine. You got day off.
So I did my last gig was in Clermont-Ferrand, and they were trying to get to Serial A. The guy went down, got hurt. I went out there. I loved it. Coach is a young African dude. He was like 40. I vibe with him was great. I had no car because I was only there for like 2 months, and I'd called games for a year at ESPN, and I would walk. I had a little flat, and I'd walk by the pastry shop and get a cappuccino and a pastry and go to practice, and then I go to the cafe, and that's where I had my lunch, and I read a book and watch some Eurosport, whatever. Yeah. Then I come back and go to practice, and then I go to the cafe, and then I come home and shut it down. It was amazing, but I couldn't do that hamster on a wheel for a long time because it was like a 2 month vacation, but that was about it.
It's hard. And it's hard being away from family for a long time too. That to me, you know, I missed so much. I missed my brother's wedding. I missed, you know, deaths in my family. And at some point, you know, you get to 27, 28, 29, I'm married, I have my first kid. I'm like, do I really want to keep missing all these things, you know? And so that's when I started to think, you know, I gotta figure this out, man. I gotta transition out of this. I love ball. I gotta stay involved in it somehow. What level and how, I don't know yet, but I gotta do something else.
Okay. Last thing. So now you want to, you're doing both training and you want to be an agent. Okay. Go ahead.
It's an interesting story how I fell into this. So I was all set to coach. I was the AD at my former high school. I did it for 2 years. I was the athletic director and I was the head coach. And it was fulfilling, rewarding. I thought I was all set to climb the coaching ranks, you know, build a program for a couple of years and try and get an assistant spot somewhere. But then my buddy who works for Priority Sports, he's an agent with us, Kieran Piller, reached out to me and said, hey, Gordon Hayward is looking for a guy on the East Coast, somebody different. And I had been training players in my off season since I was like 16, because I developed a reputation on Staten Island already. So that was like my side business. I made some cash with it. I helped a lot of kids. I developed an affinity for teaching the game as well. So I had a lot of experience with it, and I said, sure, I'll give it a try. So I did it last summer, all summer. I was up and back and forth between Boston and New York. and worked with Gordon, developed a really good relationship with him and Mark Bartelstein, who's our CEO. And conversations evolved. And I liked, to be honest, Doug, I liked watching games of Gordon, feeling emotionally invested in what he was doing. I felt like I was standing up, like going through, like, dude, you know, the pick and roll that he was taking and, you know, just talk. I was like, shit, this is like playing, you know? And for me, it just struck, it felt really, felt really good, you know? And so conversations evolved and they hired me full time. And now I kind of travel around a lot. I work with a lot of our players and I still work with Gordon, but I'm also I'm going to be representing guys next year and working with Priority Sports full time with that. So
last thing. Okay. You're a professional basketball player. As you said, I feel like I'm the best shooter in every gym, but I'm always blown away when I watch him or I help work out a pro like a Gordon Hayward at just how fucking good these guys are. Yeah, right. Like the level of their skill is so much better than any human being can conceptualize. Could you give me a, for instance?
So trying to, what I've been so impressed with working at guys at that level is how quickly they learn something. And you know, for like Gordon Hayward, right? The whole conversation was about his handle before I worked with him. It was about his handle. And his shooting and shooting from long range. So we start working together, and very quickly I realized this guy's the best, if not the best, top five at least mid range player in the NBA, and the numbers will back that up. And so there wasn't a lot for me to do with him, you know, like but it became a relationship thing and something. I digress. I think the level of which these guys can learn, like how quickly they can learn something, is people don't understand. And Gordon Hayward, mind you, is about 6'8". You know, he's super athletic, can jump off both feet, can handle with both hands, can shoot going both ways. I think people underestimate the skill that these guys have. And what, you know, everyone was taught when I was first working with Gordon, everyone would say, oh, he needs this, he needs that, he needs this. And this guy's got everything, you know. He doesn't. It's not much for me to do. It's just got to click in his head.
He's got to get his. It's a confidence thing. Well, look, you hit on three things, which I think the basketball world knows of, but I'm not sure the real world, the rest of the world. My friends, we call them civilians. They understand, right?
Yeah.
That to make the league, you got to be able to defend, right? Which is probably why you didn't make it. And I'm sure that there's so many small guards, or there's even big, like we always talk about big guys, like, yeah, but can you switch on a pick and roll and not get sliced and diced, or can you defend the rim? Right. So like the defense is way better than you thought. The second thing is how smart they are. Like we don't do a good enough job. We're so sensitive to maybe pointing out that somebody's not a quick learner, but dudes that can't pick things up, you can't play at a high level. You just can't.
Yep. Yep.
All those guys are basically different levels of basketball geniuses. And then the third part is the confidence factor, right? If you lose that, it's really hard to get it back. But the difference in the best and guys that are struggling a lot of times is just what's going on upstairs, because a lot of them have all the same skills and all that same size.
Yep. And I think it's you hit on it, how smart guys are.
Yeah.
You know, even when we make comments like, you know, his IQ just isn't, like, you know, let's be careful about when we say that, because, you know, they might be trying to figure something out or fit themselves into a different role. And that takes time. You know, that does take time. You know,
plus, if you've been wired one way, it's like Melo, right? He was wired. He was the best player, the go-to scorer. Now, all of a sudden, we want you to be a third scorer, and then we need you to play better. It's like it's a completely different. And that's when you've been doing something one way for 25, 30 years, then, hey, late in your career, that's a hard shift to make. And I also think that it's important you point out, basketball intelligence is not regular intelligence. It's
so
different.
My question, I would ask you this question, Doug, like, since you're a point guard, like, can you become a true point guard? Like, can you, you know what I mean? Like, is that, because I was always a scorer, but my size would tell you otherwise, right? My size would tell you, no, I'm a point guard. I'm 5'11", you know, good handle, could shoot, like, understand the game. But I think I try and score, you know? When I became a sophomore in Notre Dame, and then even my first couple of years when I graduated, They were trying to fit me into this point guard position. And, you know, I got to run the team. And my assists were just never, I could never get, you know what I mean? And then overseas, yeah. The coach is on me like, you know, you need to get your assists up. You need to create for others. And I'm like, look, like, this is what I am. You know?
No, this is who I am. That's like trying to tell me you need to be a scorer, right? I tried to rewire myself. Can you teach somebody to run a team?
Yeah.
I think you can coach them on. There are things you can coach them on that you can add. You'll never be able to teach somebody vision and passing, but I do think you can teach them some of the very basic stuff where you can kind of fake it. You know, in terms of mentality, it's really hard. If you're a scorer, you're thinking score. But when I work with guys that are scoring point guards, I was like, look, here's what I want you to do. I want you to think the second time I touch the ball in any offense possession, I want to score. But the first time, let's get it to the first open guy, right? Yeah. In transition, you come down, you want to attack. But after that, I need you to get the ball to somebody else. And then the second time you get it, now we can go. But there's some things that you can
teach and you can add, but I do think it's hard mentally to transition from score to point.
That's a lot of it's about fit. Like the team I had the best shot with was the Lakers. They're running triangle where you would have been better in the triangle than I was, you know, like, I mean, that's why Joe Crispin was great in it. You know, Mike Pemberthy, just a great shooter. Like I could do a lot of things Mike Pemberthy couldn't do, but I could not shoot with that guy that he made the team and I didn't. Hey, listen, this has been amazing. Your journey. Yeah. I cannot wait to see what you do next. I really appreciate your time. More than anything, I have a ton of respect for what you accomplished, what you went through, and how you accomplished what you accomplished.
Thank you, Doug. I appreciate that, man. I've been listening to you for a long time. You know that. I've been telling you about that. I love your podcast and your commentary. It's refreshing because it's honest. And I love the game and I love hearing more and I love to share my story. So, eager to move forward with this thing and happy to be here. So thank you, man. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Kyle. Wow, how great was that, right? Reminder, the Doug Gottlieb Show is daily, 3-6 Eastern Time, 12-3 Pacific. You can check it out on the iHeartRadio app, on any of your Fox Sports radio stations, even the satellite radio 203 or 217. Check that out. In the meantime, we're going to keep doing this, bringing you basketball guys and their basketball stories. Just so happened to have two Notre Dame guys back to back. But Kyle's an absolute stud playing with Orleans all those years in Pro B before shutting it down, if you will. But my thanks to him and for you to listening. I'm Doug Gottlieb, and this is All Ball.